Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. There are a few people, certainly, that I have had the privilege of knowing and working with who have done more over a long period of time in the course of that war for the free world to have it come out right than our first guest. He is John Bolton. Ambassador Bolton was, of course, our representative to the United Nations under President George W. Bush. He also served in a number of other capacities in government, including as the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security. He is today a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and the author of the best-selling book, Surrender is Not an Option. Among these many other qualities and incarnations, Ambassador Bolton has become the founder and driving force behind two extraordinary organizations, and we're delighted to have a chance to talk with him a bit about them at this point. Ambassador Bolton, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Glad to be with you, Frank.
So, talk a little bit about what you have been doing with Bolton PAC and your Bolton Super PAC.
Well, you know, it was very clear to me at the end of last year that after five years then of Barack Obama, we had a president who just simply did not care about American national security over and above getting virtually every policy decision wrong. It just wasn't a priority for him. And I worried also there were too many Republican political operatives who bought the line that foreign policy is too distant and removed from the average voter. They really don't care about it. I've never believed that. I think the American people are much more practical than their leaders in Washington. So I set up the PAC and the Super PAC to raise money to support House and Senate candidates who understand that a strong America protects our interest and helps keep the peace, something Barack Obama has never understood. And we've raised a very substantial amount of money now. We're spending independently on behalf of Tom Cotton in Arkansas, Tom Tillis in North Carolina, and Scott Brown in New Hampshire, each for their own reasons, I think important races on the national security front. We've made direct contributions to the campaigns of nearly 60 candidates for the House and 18 candidates for the United States Senate. So we're deeply involved both in helping the candidates directly and in spending independently. I think this is critical, and now we see the political operatives saying, you know, national security is going to be very important this November. Well, all I can say is no kidding. Welcome to the club.
Well, let's hope they join it. You know, one of the things, John, I don't know if you've heard about it, but we released a poll last week, actually a combination of findings of a national survey and two very interesting focus groups conducted for us by Kellyanne Conway of the Polling Company, one in Ohio and one in Florida. And boy, do they bear out what you've just said. And now the perceived conventional wisdom, it really is clear that the American people are very uneasy about the various threats they see emerging from ISIS on the one hand and beheadings and Ebola and more generally this sense of drift and incompetence at best, malfeasance at worst on the part of the administration. So I salute you for the work you're doing with these PAC organizations and the help you're giving to people who hopefully will make a real difference after November. Let me turn to another topic we'll be discussing with our friend and colleague Andy McCarthy momentarily, Ambassador Bolton, and that is the need for realism in national security policymaking. This is something you've practiced throughout your career. It is in short supply at the moment. And Andy makes the point that it's not to be confused with realpolitik. It's just rooting things in a sense of what we're really up against. Talk a little bit about what we're doing with respect to these Iranian nuclear negotiations.
Well, I think it's a perfect example of how Barack Obama lives in a dream world, completely surrounded by the bubble of his own ideology. He thinks he can negotiate Iran out of this nuclear weapons program. That is never going to happen. But the result is, and it possibly is an October surprise, possibly right after the election, if the deal is even worse than it looks like it's going to be, I think the president wants to declare success on this. And I think it's delusional what's going to happen. I think it's going to legitimize Iran's nuclear weapons program. And it all stems from utterly misreading what the Ayatollahs in Tehran are up to, what their objectives are, and what they think of us. This is a problem mirrored in case after case in the Obama foreign policy, and it all stems from living in a dream world.
One of the people who has been instrumental to crafting this dismal deal, as it has already been executed in terms of an interim arrangement, but is now taking shape as a more permanent one, is Wendy Sherman, a woman that you've had long experience with, John, in the State Department. Talk a little bit about her track record, not just in this set of parleying, but in the North Korean context, and where we find ourselves with respect to North Korea's nuclear capabilities as a result.
Well, you know, when the George W. Bush administration came into office in 2001, we inherited the handiwork of Wendy Sherman and Madeleine Albright in their negotiations with North Korea. And we were on the verge of surrender back then, giving the North Koreans, in effect, the legitimacy that they had long sought to continue their nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs. And we had to fight that in the first years of the Bush administration. It was deeply entrenched in the State Department, even in some of the political appointees who came in with the new president. And the futility of it, I think, has been demonstrated over the years. North Korea, heavily sanctioned, one of the poorest nations in the world, has exploded three nuclear devices. So the architect of the North Korea debacle in the Clinton administration is now in charge of negotiations with Iran. I mean, who would have thought that failure in North Korea could have led to this position with respect to Iran? But that's the Obama administration.
It's the Peter principle at work, I guess. But the trouble is that this is really exacerbating enormously the threats that we're facing, and doing so, as you know so well, Ambassador Bolton, at a time that we can't exactly afford a lot more danger. Again, our guest is the former permanent representative of the United States to the United Nations, Ambassador John Bolton. Let me ask you, if I may, Mr. Ambassador, to talk a little bit about the sort of trifecta that is developing in terms of, again, these sorts of, unrealistic policies. Russia, on the one hand, the failed reset with Russia, an aggressive China that we are not pivoting to contend with, after all, and global jihad, which at best we're dealing with as a kind of franchise here or there rather than conceptualizing, let alone countering it at its core as an ideological threat.
Well, these are three extraordinarily serious challenges, and the common theme that runs through them from the perspective of the Obama administration's response is weakness and ineffectiveness. I think the president's ideology rests fundamentally on the view that American power is somehow the cause of the world's problems and not part of the answer, that our presence in the world is not benign, but is really the source of much of the instability and turmoil that we see, that somehow we provoke the jihadists, that somehow if we try and appease Russia and appease China, that they will be satisfied with more limited demands. I mean, how many times in our history are we going to have to go through this? I guess the answer is for two more years. But it amplifies why national security has to be the subject of a national debate. It's possible the view that you and I hold will lose, but I don't think so. And at least if we have the debate, we can't be any worse off than we are now.
And again, I think what Kellyanne's polling data, and this is all available at securefreedom.org, folks, it makes abundantly clear that whether you're looking at people on the left, a very substantial majority of liberals, John, all the way to people on the right, who you might expect, regard peace through strength, the practice of national security policy rooted in realism that our old boss Ronald Reagan applied, is to be preferred over the idea that if we just disengage from the world, everybody else will leave us alone. And you're absolutely right. This is high time for a debate. The kinds of people that you're supporting with your PAC, I think, will help us effect a course correction if elected. I hope everyone listening to this program and to you and your various other outlets, and they are myriad, and thank God for them, will respond to your appeal to participate very directly in reconstituting what I think of as kind of the peace through strength gene in the body politic and getting it back into play at the national level. Ambassador Bolton, we appreciate your service to our country, both that in the past in public life and that you're providing today. We look forward to hearing more about your endorsements in the near future and hope that what you're saying about the need for corrective action will be taken to heart and will come to pass. Keep up the great work, sir. Come back to us very soon. Until then, Godspeed. Next up, and promised, Andy McCarthy on real politic and real national security policy. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
Are you looking to hire an IT specialist or a logistics expert, a medical technician, or a security professional? Well, there are some very qualified candidates out there. America's wounded warriors. These men and women returning from battle are eager to get back to life at home and a good job. Some have wounds you can see, and some have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. For these accomplished professionals, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These warriors have world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork. And to ensure proper placement for each individual, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right candidate for the job. When your company is looking to hire talented, highly trained employees, contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home the brave.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. One of the high points of our week is our visit with Andy McCarthy, the former federal prosecutor turned pundit par excellence. His columns are required reading at National Review Online and at PJ Media. He also publishes elsewhere and, of course, is a regular at Fox News. He is one of our regulars, and we're always pleased to have him with us, particularly for his perspectives on the various places where national security and the law seem to intersect. Andy McCarthy, welcome back. It's great to have you with us.
Frank, great to be with you.
You have rendered a wonderful public service twice in the past week with your appearance at the National Security Action Summit. And by the way, people can watch the video of that at homelandthreats.org. But you also spoke yesterday in introducing one of our greatly admired patriots and friends, Judge Michael Mukasey, the former attorney general, at an event that we had in New York City. In both of these appearances, you talked about the need for realism in the evolution and definition and execution of national security and foreign policy. I think that's probably an indisputable proposition as a general rule, but talk about why it's so necessary to think and act on it as a corrective at the present time.
Yeah, Frank, I always feel that you have to have a disclaimer at the beginning, because I'm not really talking about realism as in the realpolitik school of foreign policy, which is a very technical, classical sort of area. I'm at a much more mundane level arguing that we need to formulate American national security policy around American national interests, as opposed to somebody's sense of what global interests are, and secondly, with a real world understanding of the facts around us, rather than illusion, which is, I think, what we've based our policy on, most particularly in the national security area.
Our guest is Andy McCarthy. We're talking about how we get our national security and foreign policy footings again, grounded in realism. And Andy, you were about to give us an example of what is wrong at the moment with an unreal foreign policy under the Obama administration.
Well, Frank, I think the president has premised our national security and foreign policy for the entirety of his administration on the notion that there are such a thing as moderate Islamists who the United States can partner with, and who will be a key to stability in the Middle East, and therefore key to advancing American interests, as the president oddly, eccentrically perceives them. And I think the whole notion of moderate Islamists is a contradiction in terms, and that's a large part of the reason why the president's policy has had the inevitable result of empowering anti-Americans and jihadists.
And you have tumbled onto the fact that one of the places where you have this kind of unrealism on the one hand, and I think you coined the phrase for it, fraud, on the other hand, is in the characterization of some of those immoderate Islamists, notably this so-called Khorasan group. Talk a little bit about what you've ferreted out in terms of who these guys really are and how different, if at all, they are from, say, those moderate Islamists of the Muslim Brotherhood stripe, shall we say.
Yeah, well, I think the Khorasan group, Frank, is just a board of advisors around Zawahiri, who is the head of al-Qaeda, which is to say it's al-Qaeda. It's not a separate organization. It's not a separate terrorist entity.
One might even say core al-Qaeda, right?
or core is on al-Qaeda, right. But I think that, what the administration does, because the president has said so many times that he's destroyed this enemy, is it has to come up with other names for it, because the enemy is anything but destroyed. So they don't like to say al-Qaeda, given what the president's represented about al-Qaeda. As far as their relations with the Muslim Brotherhood, again, I think we have a history, and those of us who've looked at the Muslim Brotherhood closely, I think, can explain this, and it seems to be a fairly obvious point that people seem to miss. But The Muslim Brotherhood's ideology very much endorses violent jihad to move the Sharia agenda along. It is to the Brotherhood, in practice, one item on a very broad menu. And I think what often happens is with young people who get indoctrinated in this ideology, there's a certain disconnect at times between the ideology as endorsed by the Brotherhood and the approach as practiced by, you know, Brotherhood superiors who say, yes, we want terror, but, you know, we use it strategically, and otherwise we're trying to bore into the system.
Yeah, we use it when we're strong enough to have it be successful, and until that time, we do the penetration subversion operation of the civilization jihad.
Yeah, and I think, but I think for the young person, the disconnect is that, you know, once you buy onto the idea of pure Sharia and jihad to further it along, they get very impatient with the Brotherhood, and that's why they naturally graduate to these other jihadist organizations, and why you have this lengthy history, for example, of high-ranking figures in the Muslim Students Associations, which is a Muslim Brotherhood building block in terms of their infrastructure in the United States, actually moving on to organizations like Al-Qaeda.
It's the entry-level drug, in other words, I guess you'd say. And in this case, very clearly, again, the end game, the ultimate objectives are absolutely the same. There are some differences on tactics and timing, but not on the goals. And Eddie, speaking of those who are acting on the goals of this global jihad to have Sharia imposed worldwide and a caliphate to rule according to it, talk a little bit about the current effort of the Obama administration to defeat and ultimately destroy the Islamic State.
Well, I think it's much more of a rhetorical twist than it is a real effort. You know, the Islamic State, which is really Al-Qaeda 2.0. It's a kind of a renegade branch of Al-Qaeda that's broken off, and I think ultimately will reconcile, by the way, and probably not too far in the ultimate future. But, you know, I think that the president says things in terms of foreign policy more to manage the news cycle and the political calendar than to do anything substantive in terms of trying to advance American interest. And I really believe that what's going on at the moment, this half-hearted air campaign with no ground support, which is really having almost no effect meaningfully on the Islamic State, which continues to rampage through Iraq and Syria and capture more territory, I really think this is just to get them through the election, which is, you know, just a few weeks away. And I'd be very surprised if there was much appetite to continue this after the election's over.
Well, especially if we're finding that our Iraqi allies are being overrun and we have no effective allies on the Syrian side of this ledger. And it really looks as though we're setting up a rout here, which is a non-trivial problem, needless to say, when, among other places, Jordan and Israel and Saudi Arabia and Lebanon and perhaps points farther north and west will be under the influence of this rising caliphate. Andy McCarthy, God help us if that happens, but I know you will be standing watch and raising the alarm and helping to counter it in all of your various channels. Thank you not least for what you've been doing to try to warn us against the effects of the national security fraud and unrealism that has been guiding us now for some time. Keep up that great work and come back to us again next week, if you will. Next up, Peter Husey joins us. We'll talk with him about the Iran nuclear negotiations and the lessons learned on missile defense from Israel's Iron Dome. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Vice President Joe Biden is like the proverbial broken clock. He's right twice a day. When Biden is right, though, he has to apologize for it. At least that's what he's lately had to do for telling the truth about several of our so-called allies in President Obama's failing effort to defeat and ultimately destroy the jihadists doing business as the Islamic State. The Veep told a Harvard audience recently that Turkey had admitted allowing such terrorists to cross into Syria. He said that the United Arab Emirate and Saudi Arabia had been arming the Islamic State's fellow jihadists doing business as Al-Qaeda's Al-Nusra Front. The scandal is not that Joe Biden gave offense by his truth-telling. The scandal is the truth about such false friends. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, I'm very pleased to say, joined by Peter Husey. He is the president of a consulting firm he calls Geostrategic Analysis. He has served his country in a number of capacities in the past, notably on Capitol Hill and in the Department of Interior many years ago, but he has served a very important purpose in his post-government life in terms of helping the rest of us understand and stay abreast of developments in the national security arena through programs that he has been sponsoring at the Capitol Hill Club over many years, and I'm privileged to be attending them from time to time. Peter, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Nice to talk to you, Frank.
I want to get your thoughts on a subject that is seemingly slipping away from us, Peter. It is the effort to restrain Iran from gaining nuclear weapons capabilities. You have, of course, been monitoring the negotiations that the president has assured us are going to prevent that from happening. That ain't so, as best I can tell. But we're also now hearing from some in the sort of pro-Iran community making excuses or otherwise trying to minimize the risks associated with such a development. Talk about where the negotiations stand as you see it and the excuse makers.
Well, I think, Frank, the two issues came up. Former Ambassador Charles Freeman said that the only thing about Iran is an imagined nuclear program, that they really don't have a weapons program. And Paul Pilar, who used to be in the intelligence community, said that the requirement to make Iran fess up to what it was doing back in 2003 and so forth on nuclear warheads is really stupid because we don't want to push them too hard. And it's the neocons, people such as yourself, I guess, are pushing the United States to insist on that. A couple of things need to be said. As Bibi Netanyahu says, you don't need all these centrifuges to produce nuclear energy, and they don't have two nuclear power plants, both of which you need to have a nuclear energy for electricity. So what are all these centrifuges in the tens of thousands? That's number one. Second thing is, it's the IAEA that has insisted that Iran come clean on its previous programs. The third point is, everybody says they stopped their warhead design in 2003. Well, the only reason we know that is they bulldozed everything and destroyed every facility that had been discovered by the internal Iranian group MEK that then revealed to the world that Iran had nuclear weapons program. That's the only reason they stopped it. But the question is, did they move it? Did they put it elsewhere? We didn't know what was going on in 2003, yet we're assured by both Paul Pilar's of the world that we will absolutely know exactly what Iran does should they cheat on a new deal. I think the argument is unassailable that, like South Africa, which gave up its nuclear weapons, it didn't say, can we keep a few? Can we keep some centrifuges? No, it took 7 years for South Africa, once they gave up their nukes, for them to be able to come back into the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Administration, and have the right under certain conditions to have nuclear power. Why should Iran be treated any differently? The question is, we, I think, gave the game away up front by saying the end deal will determine the nature of Iran's enrichment program. Well, if they have an enrichment program, the question in my mind is, why? What do they need it for? Certainly not electricity.
Peter, look, as you know so well, what we're witnessing, and again, it's not all been discovered, but what has been discovered in terms of deeply buried facilities, the nuclear centrifuge inventory, as you say, which is growing and becoming more productive, more capable by the day, these are signs of intent that only the most naive ignore. And you know, I'm struck by the fact that we very narrowly avoided having this Ambassador Chaz Freeman as the head of the National Intelligence Council for the United States government. This has been a disaster.
You go back in 1991 when we kicked Saddam out of Kuwait. We then had Mr. Butler and Mr. Kayes at the UN determined that Saddam was 6 months to a year away from having a nuclear weapon, and we didn't know that. We didn't know about the Libyan program until we intercepted the BBC China freighter. And lo and behold, there are all these centrifuges from the Khan network in Pakistan on their way to Tripoli. So you look at North Korea, again, we had some inkling, but it wasn't until 1994-95 we all of a sudden said, holy cow, they probably have, as Secretary of Defense Bill Perry put it, probably 1 to 2 nuclear weapons. And so my view is, you've got to get rid of the centrifuges in Iran, and they have to come clean. So you start basically with a clean slate, and you're confident that Iran does not have the capability to move towards a nuclear weapon. And I don't see why, if Iran has no interest in nuclear weapons, what's the problem?
Peter Husey, let me switch gears with you. The anti-missile defense industry, as you call it, has been beavering away now for many years, trying to prevent the United States from having a comprehensive missile defense of the kind that so clearly is necessary in the kind of environment you're talking about. It's not just Iran, it's Russia and China and North Korea and others. Talk a little, if you would, about insights that we've gleaned or should be gleaning, at least, from the Israeli experience dealing with relatively small-scale threats, but nonetheless quite successfully with their Iron Dome program.
Well, it's amazing. Hamas and Hezbollah in 2006, 12, and 14 launched more rockets on Israel than Nazi Germany launched on Britain in all of World War II. In 2006, they had no defense against Hezbollah rockets. 53 Israelis died. Now, comparatively, if you take into account population, 53 dead Israelis is the same as 2,000 dead Americans. In 2012, with Iron Dome first being deployed, even though they had thousands of rockets launched at them, the death toll was 5. In 2014, you had 4,479 rockets, more than at any other time, over 50 days, launched at Israel, and the death toll was 2, and that came from a Hamas rocket in an area that wasn't defended by Iron Dome. If you look at the numbers, Iron Dome tried to intercept close to 870 rockets. They intercepted 785 of them. About 80 got through. And they have a good bomb shelter system, but the thing is, the property damage was considerably less than today than it was previously, and the fatality rate went down 97%. And the Israelis figure that it was an 89.5% to 90% of all the rockets they tried to engage, they shot down.
Yeah, and it's important to note that they chose not to engage those that they thought were not likely to harm, you know, people or property.
Many thousands went into undeveloped areas, the desert. Some fell back down on Gaza. Some went into the ocean. These are not guided rockets, which people seem to think is cool. It doesn't matter. Well, when they're unguided, it's very difficult to figure out where they're going, and the fact that the Israelis can figure this out in a matter of milliseconds is, I think, fascinating.
And this is a program, of course, that we helped them put together, and it bears witness to the fact that we can put missile defenses, effective missile defenses, in place. So why aren't we doing more of that, Peter, at this point, to protect the American people against more sophisticated rockets or missile threats?
Frank, you know, here's the theory. I've just finished a long essay, which will come out soon, on this. The people who don't like missile defense say that it has to be 100% effective because you're dealing with, they assume, nuclear weapons. And because they think it's not 100% successful, and they think the successes we've had are tests that are rigged. In fact, they said this all the way back in the Clinton administration, that therefore the system is not effective. They have a phrase, they say, no defense is better than some defense. Now, to be fair, some of them have talked about, well, if you went to boost phase intercept or space, you don't have to worry about decoys and countermeasures, which we have to deal with now, and that would work. But they've gone long ago. They've decided they're not even going to go there. They don't like missile defense because they see it as a substitute for arms control and a substitute for negotiations. One of them said, missile defense is a go-it-alone philosophy of the Bush administration. I mean, we're going to defend ourselves and the rest of the world, we don't need you. Well, we got, what, 24 countries are cooperating with us on missile defense. They said that missile defense isn't going to work because it'll blow up arms control. Well, what did Bush do? He cut nuclear weapons from 6,000 to 2,200, almost a 70% decrease. At the same time, he built missile defenses and got out of the ABM treaty. So he proved that you could do missile defense and do arms control or reduce nuclear weapons.
More importantly, that you could protect the American people. We just aren't doing enough of it by my lights. Peter Husey, we're out of time. I hope you'll come back to us. I want to talk with you particularly about a terrific program that you had recently with the Minot Task Force on the future of the road forward, I guess it is, on strategic nuclear forces. Thank you so much for joining us, and keep up the great work you're doing at Geostrategic Analysis. Next, Kevin Freeman, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I lost my arm.
I lost my legs.
But you can't see what I lost. Over 625,000 vets are suffering from traumatic brain injury
and post-traumatic stress. They're the wounds you can't see.
But with your help, we can expose the invisible wounds of war.
And get these veterans the help they desperately need.
100% of your donation goes toward building treatment centers. Help heal the invisible wounds of war. Donate at makeitvisible.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At America'sMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families.
Including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at DailyCaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by Kevin Freeman, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, the founder and CEO of Freeman Global Investment Council, and the president and driving force behind a new and remarkable organization, the National Security Investment Consultant Institute. We'll be hearing more about that in the weeks and months ahead. But Kevin is a man who has specialized, given his training as a chartered financial analyst, to help us think through and make sense of the threats of economic warfare against the United States. He's the author of two best-selling books, Game Plan: How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack, and his first, Secret Weapon: How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again. Kevin Freeman, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank.
You have been writing, among other things, about China and the fact that we are indeed continuing to treat it as a friend, and it is behaving ever more like an adversary or even an enemy. Talk a little bit about the evidence that supports that conclusion, Kevin.
Just recently, the director of the FBI came out and basically said China is acting like a drunken burglar on the internet, breaking into our house and stealing our TV and everything else that's not bolted down. And that comes on the heels of China offering the world's largest internet IPO, actually the world's largest IPO of any kind, $25 billion of American money invested into Alibaba. Why would we allow them to take our money and give us Alibaba, and at the same time they're breaking in our houses via the internet and stealing everything they possibly can? It defies logic.
Now, Kevin, is there a reason to believe that Alibaba will be used by the Chinese in the future as an instrument for further burglaring of our privacy and our proprietary information, both business and personal?
Well, just logically, let's apply the fact that Alibaba did not become the world's largest IPO without full Chinese permission. Jack Ma, the founder, became the richest man in China, and that does not happen in a communist country like China without full government support. The second thing we know is that when U.S. internet companies operate in China, they're required by the Chinese government to hand over everything they know about their customers. So we can assume that Chinese company Alibaba operating anywhere in the world is going to be a backdoor for the Chinese government to learn everything they can. I mean, if they'll hack us, they certainly will take the information legally, and Americans will likely just click the box, I've read the rules and I approve, and literally hand over everything that they've handed to Google or to eBay or PayPal. All that information will then be in the hands of a Chinese corporation.
Kevin, let me switch gears. At the same time that we're confronting growing evidence of Chinese aggressiveness in the economic warfare space, you have recently posted at globaleconomicwarfare.com a very important piece about why Vladimir Putin is smiling. What are the Russians up to in this portfolio?
Well, one might assume that Putin would be frowning. The ruble is crashing. The Russian economy looks weak. Oil prices are down. Everything looks on paper like it's going against him. And yet he's smiling because he knows that while we're playing and manipulating numbers, he's building relationships. And one of those relationships is with China. And so we see evidence, for example, of a $400 billion gas deal between Russia and China that does not involve dollars. We see Putin smiling because Wall Street Journal runs an article recently that says that Putin is called Putin the Great in China, and how he's perceived as a strong leader by the Chinese people, and as their attitude towards America has diminished, their attitude towards Russia has improved. And so he's laying the ground with multi-hundred-billion-dollar banking deals around the world to replace the U.S. dollar whenever it's feasible. And so we're consoling ourselves, well, the dollar looks strong, there's no other place for money to go. At the same time, he's making arrangements for other places for money to go. And literally, if you look at it, he's winning the relationships in the hearts and minds in China. He's winning the relationship, or will win the relationship, in Europe, especially if there's a hard winter. We're looking weak on the world stage, even as the dollar appears strong. He's looking strong on the world stage, even as the ruble appears weak.
Explain how that will work in Europe. Europe is, at least at the governmental level, rather irritated with the Russians at the moment, as you know, imposing sanctions of various kinds as a result of its aggression towards Ukraine, why would he be winning hearts and minds with the Europeans?
Well, he will win them in a harsh winter. He controls the gas supplies, and Europe knows that they are desperately dependent on Russian supplies in a hard winter. They need the natural gas he supplies. He uses this card every year, every time it's cold, and he will apply that card again. The Europeans are equally irritated with the United States. They viewed us as weak on the world stage, that, you know, we pulled out of the Middle East too quickly and so forth. They're not rushing to our arms against Russia, so to speak, but they are definitely upset over the Ukraine, but they're also equally aware that's where the natural gas supplies are and there may be a harsh winter ahead.
And this would be not only a question of making sure that they have sufficient supplies of gas, but also at attractive terms, Kevin Freeman?
Absolutely, attractive terms. And remember that Putin's been in Europe lobbying against hydraulic fracking, funding environmental groups and so forth, so that they're not able to develop, because of political constraints, their own natural gas supplies.
Kevin Freeman is our guest. He is the founder and CEO of Freeman Global Investment Council, also the new National Security Investment Consultant Institute. We'll be talking more about that in the days ahead. Also the author of Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again. And Kevin, one thing you touched on just a moment ago, and I'd like to just take a minute or two to drill down on. You have indicated for some time concern that the reserve currency status of the U.S. dollar is in jeopardy. Talk a little bit about what the Russians and Chinese seem to be up to in that regard and what there might be in the way of an alternative.
Sure. The Russians and Chinese have been structurally undermining the dollar for several years. And what I mean by that is, the thing that keeps a dollar strong globally is the fact that it's used in oil transactions and energy transactions. We owe almost $18 trillion worldwide, and we have to fund $8 trillion a year in total rollover debt. So by its nature, our debt would argue for a weak dollar. Now, there are several factors. One is the rest of the world, other than the Middle East and China, have debt problems as well. So that augurs for a stronger dollar. But the Chinese have decided that they want to create an alternative currency. And they're working with the Russians to build up gold reserves. They're working with the Russians to use their currency reserves. In China, it's over $4 trillion of net currency reserves. And to trade other currencies, they're working with the BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, to build alternatives to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. They're setting the structure in place so the world can live without dollars. And they even said that. The Chinese said in an official news agency report, we have to de-Americanize the world, which means we have to remove the dollar's reserve currency. What they're looking to replace it with will either be a combination, a strategic drawing right, which is what the United Nations has proposed, which would be a combination of various currencies and gold, or a gold-backed Chinese renminbi. That would also substitute for the dollar, at least in certain transactions. And they're rapidly ramping this up. They're trying to internationalize their currency right now, and they're doing it at such an extraordinary pace. We're not noticing because the dollar appears to be strong at the current moment, and it's like Wile E. Coyote running off the edge of the cliff, not realizing there's nothing underneath him anymore.
And no problem on the way down. Kevin Freeman, we have to leave it at that. Thank you very much. These insights, particularly in terms of this whole national security portfolio of economic warfare, in which you really are expert, is deeply appreciated. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.